Leading Ideas Talks is brought to you by the Lewis Center for Church Leadership of Wesley Theological Seminary in Washington, D.C. Subscribe free to our weekly newsletter at www.churchleadership.com/leading ideas. How can dreaming big help your church reach more people? Lewis Center Director Doug Poe speaks with Reverend Olu Brown of Impact Church in Atlanta about how to creatively reach new people through extreme hospitality and by dreaming big.
Welcome to Leading Ideas Talks, a podcast featuring thought leaders and innovative practitioners. I'm Douglas Poe, the director of the Lewis Center and your host for this talk. Joining me is the Reverend Olu Brown of Impact Church in Atlanta, Georgia. Our focus for this podcast is reaching more people. Olu, what are you reading right now or have you read recently that is influencing your thinking on leadership?
Great. Doug, thanks for having me as a guest. A couple of things. One, from a group perspective, we recently hired a new executive director and just making sure we're charting on the same course together. There's a wonderful book called Leading from the Second Chair by Mike Bonham and Roger Patterson that really focuses on executive leadership in the local church if you're not a senior or a lead pastor. So that's something I'm doing internally along with one of my team members. Personally, really loving Brené Brown's Braving the Wilderness, and it is just speaking to my soul in some very dynamic and powerful ways. And then from leadership stuff, I just really finished Essentialism by Greg McCowan, and this whole focus of shifting from focusing on 20 different things to focusing on the main thing. And so Essentialism, Leading from the Second Chair, and Braving the Wilderness are the ones that are current with me right now.
So of the three you name, I'm least familiar with Braving the Wilderness, and it sounds fascinating. So can you share a little bit more about what you're picking up from this book and sort of any ways you're applying it?
Yeah, well, great book. Brené Brown is very well known, and she's a college professor, also author. And so the subtitle of the book is The Quest for the True Belonging and the Courage to Stand Alone. So she spends a good bit of the time helping the reader understand that you are unique, you are gifted. That doesn't mean it gives you a license to, as she talks about, dehumanizing people. So this book talks a lot about our culture politically, where we are, and how a lot of our words have dehumanized people instead of rehumanizing them. So it is a book about knowing who you are and acknowledging that and living your own truth. But it's also about acknowledging the truth of others and respecting who they are. And not diminishing a person because they may look, feel, or act differently than you. But really great inward focused book to help the reader understand that wherever they happen to be in life is a place that will take them a little bit further down the road if they are willing to dare to be themselves.
So, I appreciate what you were just saying. And I actually find it interesting, having sort of experienced your ministry, this idea of rehumanizing it. It seems to me that's a part of what you're actually trying to do at Impact. Do you agree, or do you think I'm misreading what your efforts are?
No, you're right on target. It is this rehumanization that, of course, from Brené Brown's work, Braving the Wilderness, and you see it a lot, sadly, in the local church, and you're a scholar, and the work that you do empowers so many. The church history that we study, honestly and openly, is very painful, where we have misrepresented the truth, misrepresented Christ, and we've done a lot of hurt and damage as individuals, as institutions, and even as countries, those that profess Christianity. And so one of the ways we've done that is by dehumanizing people. And I think that's what made Dr. King and others from the civil rights movement so powerful, is that one, they were able to look in the mirror and say, I am a man, I am a woman, I'm not imperfect, I'm not broken. And they rehumanize the human race, in particular, what it was hoped to have been in the United States of America. And when I look at our ministry, out of all the things that we hope we will be able to do to create a legacy, I hope that people will say most consistently is they make me feel valued as a person. So that's key for us in our ministry.
And as you we get into your ministry, do you mind sharing a little bit about the context of Impact and just sort of give people a brief overview of the work you've been doing?
Yes, thank you. And so we are now 11 years old as a local church. And I was telling the congregation on Sunday, there are people who visit us from around the world in different ways who really can't believe that our church is 11 years old, because through grace and favor and just wonderful team members and leadership, we've been able to do a lot of things that some churches 100 or 150 years old haven't been able to do. We started with a group of 25 people, and now statistically, as it relates to United Methodism, we're one of the fastest growing 25 churches in the country. There are about 2,400 people in person who worship with us in person every week, and then another 2,000 online. But those aren't the greatest stats for us. You know, the things that I cherish more than anything is last year we had 83 of our young people commit their lives to Jesus Christ. I look out and we pick up college students every single weekend for our 12 noon experience in one of our campuses. We are able to take mission trips that are helping to impact the missionaries, and my hope is for those that we're reaching. So we're an 11-year-old church. We've got two campuses, and we're a group of people who oftentimes some would say, hey, don't belong in the church because we don't always look like church people or act like church people. But I think that is the secret sauce of who we are. We really are a collective of individuals who know the grace of God, and we're just grateful to be serving in ministry for this season.
And let's talk a little bit about that secret sauce, because you talked about people sometimes say, you all don't look like church people, which, you know, of course I find fascinating because they have a certain perception of what church people look like. But share how you sort of go about helping people to feel comfortable. I think that's one of the things that has really helped your ministry, that when you walk in, you feel comfortable and you feel like you can be yourself. And that's not something you can experience at whenever you go to every congregation.
Mm-hmm. Well, we practice what is called extreme hospitality. I'm working on a book now that hopefully will be out from Abington this time next year, which is the 4D Church. And there are four keys, and one of the most important is hospitality. And so extreme hospitality means the following: all people are welcome, all people are worthy, and all people have a place. Now, you take someone, for instance, who really cannot sing, but they want to be a part of a choir or a worship team. Yes, they have a place, but the best place may not be for them in the choir. We'll find another place for you to be.
And you can plan on joining your choir, old Luke.
But of course, you know, you can take that example and you can stretch it across a political perspective. You can stretch it across sexuality. You can do anything with it. And for me, it always comes back down to all people are welcome. So to answer your question, practicing extreme hospitality has won a lot of people to Impact and ultimately Jesus Christ. But it has also turned a lot of people away from our local church, which is painful and hurtful and sad to me. But I do believe that we practice heaven right now, and it would be a shame to get to heaven and not have practiced what the kingdom looks like on earth.
I agree. And you talked about the pain. Why is it that you think people are turned off by you're being so hospitable? Is it just that it goes against sort of their perception of what church should be like? They're just not ready for seeing all kind of different people come together. What is it that sort of challenges individuals who aren't ready for the extreme hospitality?
Yeah, it's a bit of all of it, because when a person in particular who has been a part of a faith community goes to a faith community, they're working out of a pattern that is from childhood, young adulthood, whatever, versus the person who's never been to church, so they don't have any expectation, which is why I believe non-church people are taken aback when we don't practice hospitality. So for some people, they say they want to practice hospitality, but they mean, I want to be around all people who agree with me, who look like me, who are in my socioeconomic status. I remember the great theologian James Cone, when I was in seminary, talked about power, and in particular in this context in capitalism. and how power is never really shared in a capitalistic society. It has to be almost taken. And when we think about power, we all have power. We think about economic power, but many of us have so many forms of power we would never think about. And the challenge with extreme hospitality is, like the life of Christ, it causes you to willingly share your power. And it doesn't matter who you are, we love our power. And that is problematic when I have to share my power or give my power away. And a quick example may be simply, you know, when I was a leader of this group, everyone knew the right restaurant because that was a restaurant that I liked. But when we became a more inclusive group and allowed some other people into this small group from a different culture, we discovered that that wasn't the best restaurant in the world, but there were other people who had other cultural desires of certain food selections. And so as a leader, I had to decide, do I let go of some of my power and become more inclusive in my approach to where we eat as a small group? So it's very simple things, but also very problematic things that we see facing many of our countries in our world today that cause war and catastrophic events related to humanity.
Yeah, thank you. I'm going to change up a little bit and talk about one of the goals you set as a church. And that goal is to sort of connect dreamers and change agents. And I sort of like that terminology, dreamers and change agents. Can you sort of explain to people what you mean by those terms and then how you are pursuing that goal as a congregation?
Yeah, we believe in dreaming, and we also believe in action. And so you bring those two together, you've got a powerful dream and you have an action. Going back to the illustration of Dr. King, although he wasn't able to realize the fulfillment of his dream, he and others were actively involved in creating the action steps, which is why he was killed in Memphis, Tennessee, taking action steps to help disenfranchise garbage truck drivers realize the American dream. So how does that play out in our local church? It means that we are consistently looking at who we are today and also asking God who we want to be tomorrow. We just finished a 5-year strategic plan that helps us dream bigger dreams. Now, it is a great strategic plan, but I would tell you it would be a worthless strategic plan if there weren't action steps attached to it. So even as early as today, I was in a team meeting with a report out on our action steps to fulfilling a particular part of this strategic plan, which is a dream for us. And one of those dreams is to have a world-class NextG. That is the brand word we use for our youth ministry. So in the next 5 years, we want to have a world-class youth experience, not only in our building, but beyond our building. And so there are particular action steps that we're putting in place to make that dream a reality. So that's a really fresh and current example of how we're doing that in our local church.
So a couple of questions related to this. The first is, a lot of congregations, they use different language, but they're trying to accomplish what you're doing. Can you share some insights with sort of how do you get people to dream big? I think sometimes people only dream as big as of what they can see. So how do you get them to sort of expand the dream to something bigger? And then secondly, then how do you build the concrete steps to actually help people to move towards that dream?
Yeah, we're not perfect at it. And so one of the ways we do it is by showing our imperfection, to talk about opportunities that we've had individually or as a congregation. And we dream big dreams and put the steps in place, but things didn't always work out. So the first thing we do is to help people to understand that they're not a failure because a particular dream didn't work out. Sometimes you didn't have the right resources, or going back to the book Essentialism, you were focused on 5 parts of the dream when year one, you should have only been focused on part 1 of that dream. How do we do that in a practical standpoint? One, spirituality is important, and we believe in the power of prayer. We believe in the power of faith. And so an attachment to you fulfilling your dreams as a part of our local church is spiritual, and that is the base foundation. Secondly, we also believe in great coaches and mentors. And so we're always trying to connect people with others who are already fulfilling certain dreams. You know, after church this past Sunday, a person came up who has a relative who's in his early 20s and said, hey, I think he needs a mentor. So I immediately began thinking about other men who have achieved certain things that he would connect with. So coaching and mentorship, spiritual as a foundation. And then the third is it's accountability. And that is very spiritual. We all need accountability partners. You know, I think about my workout plan over the last couple of days. I typically wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and try to head towards the gym at 4:30 and go from 5 to 6. But the last couple of days, I really haven't been on my plan. And so me having an accountability partner who helps me fulfill and stay connected to my dream of having a healthier lifestyle is so key and so important. And so at Impact, we're not shy about that. We talk about accountability. We talk about partnership. We talk about being real with each other. And so, you know, for me, it is the spiritual, it's the coaching, it's the mentoring, and it's also about the accountability. Those are the processes that I use personally and our congregation uses pragmatically to help people connect with their dreams.
I appreciate that because I do agree with you. I think the toughest part for most of us is the accountability that when you start something, you're excited, but then as you get into it, sometimes you can start creating excuses for why today I won't do it or whatever takes place. But if you have someone who's accountable that can help you stay accountable, it makes it easier for you to keep moving forward. The second piece of what you talked about was sort of this new effort with youth. And certainly as we talk about reaching more people, I can't think of any congregation that does not want to connect with more youth. So can you talk about some of the things without maybe giving away too many things in your strategic plan of how you really plan on connecting with more youth?
Yeah. One of the ways is by looking at this word called relevant. And this can be a very controversial word in the church because what it means to be relevant is different from context to context. But you really have to look at it. And so then you partner the word relevant with authentic. So some people think if we're relevant with the current culture, we can't be authentic to our values. But if you look at for-profit organizations and you take an audio company, for instance, that makes a particular type of audio player, that audio player may have originally come onto the market in 1975. And now in 2018, it is one of the best sellers. The original purpose of that audio player is to provide music audibly to the listener. Now, if you look at the packaging and the transformation of packaging from it first coming into the marketplace to now 2018, it's probably changed 10 or 15 times. It's the exact opposite with the local church. We want to keep our consistent messaging, which is fine, but we are afraid of packaging and retooling that so that current and younger generations will hear it and receive it. So that's one of the primary reasons why a lot of churches aren't reaching younger people. They're not willing to retool and repackage the authenticity of their message. And then secondly, it has a little bit to do with the architecture in some cases, although we're finding there are young people who like traditional buildings. There are some people who don't, and you've got to know your community. So it means you got to get outside of your walls and find out what speaks best to the younger generations around you. And if you can afford to, then build towards that and don't build the opposite, expecting them to come. Number three, and I think it is the most important, it is relationships. Relationships. It's hard for me to draw somebody I really don't like or someone I really don't know or understand. And so what I'm finding with younger generations is they really want deep and abiding relationships with people who we would call elders, people who we would call not necessarily their direct parent, but a parent figure. And so older adults and adults hopefully know that young people are craving deep and abiding relationships, but they have to be relevant and they have to be very authentic. And if we're not going to be authentic and if we're not going to be relevant, they will not spend the time that it takes to make that connection. So those are three things that I think are low-hanging fruit to some degree, but yet will cause most congregations to have to stretch a little bit to see that reality happen.
And to pick up on relevant from a couple different perspectives, first, talking about worship. You are quite creative in worship. So I don't know if it's you or you have a team that thinks about this, but can you share about sort of your approach? Because you just don't think about it as I get up every week and I deliver this sort of lecture sermon and we come back and we do the next week, we do the same thing. But you're willing to sort of be open to, you know, using that space to share the story in various ways.
Great. And one of the things that I was just doing today, right before I came on this podcast, was our team was meeting with a consultant who's very well known in the United Methodist circles and beyond. His name is Jason Moore. He's founder of Midnight Oil Productions. And what's so amazing is people will say, you know, exactly what you just said, but what they don't realize is we are constantly retraining and retreading what we call worship. And Jason was just talking to us about what he believes makes powerful worship, and I'll offer it to you in the conversation, and that is metaphor. And when you look at the life of Jesus, you know, he constantly uses metaphor through parable. And so what has happened in the current reality or the current generation of what we would call the Christian church, in particular in the U.S., is that we are not doing the hard work of using metaphor that applies to 21st century. So, for instance, we'll give a biblical illustration and we will think that a person in the pew quickly understands it, but they don't. We'll also name parts of our building in words and terms that no one understands anymore. Someone will say, hey, if you want to be a volunteer, sign up in the Northex. And I've never been in church in my life or certain types of buildings. I have no idea what the Northex is.
Yeah, you think Seuss probably, right? You're thinking Dr. Seuss character?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I really want to be a volunteer, but you miss me that day. One, because I'm too embarrassed to ask you where that is or what it is. And so I move on with my life. But so that's one powerful metaphor. And you can use metaphor through digital. You can use metaphor in your bulletin. You can use metaphor from the time if you're on a sermon series or a particular need, from the time somebody drives into your parking lot until the time someone leaves. I remember we were doing a construction sermon series. And so the greeters had on hard hats and we had construction looking sites throughout the space so that even before a song was sung or a message was preached, people already understood we were driving for a metaphor. And the last thing, we don't call worship a service at Impact. And this is something we constantly teach, in particular with newcomers who are volunteers or staff, because we call it an experience. From the moment you come on campus to the moment you leave. And it is also the same for online. So from the moment you log into the website to the moment you leave, we want to give you an experience that, one, makes you feel welcome, two, makes you feel valued, and three, there is a call to action so that you know. And I like what Jason said. He says, you know, we're planning church too much for Sunday when we got to be planning church for Monday. Because as he said, it's the lay people who are going to take the message into the world that as a local pastor, you know, I will never meet many of the people our lay people meet. And if we can empower them on Sunday with an experience and then take that Monday, then we will do Matthew's gospel go into all the world.
So as you were talking about metaphor, I also know that you are intergenerational in your congregation, and you use the example you all did, the construction one. So how do you make sure the metaphor speaks to all the different generations? So as you think about construction, so how do you pick up elements to say, I know that young people sort of in the middle and older people all will sort of get something out of this metaphor?
And there are times when we're successful with that, and there are times when you can't be successful, meaning there is a particular target age or demographic that you'll probably lean the greatest percentage of your resources towards. And for us, that is going to be middle to lower as it relates to age groups. But one of the ways to help mitigate that is by not preparing worship or a sermon in a silo, as many church leaders do. Prepare it with a team, and if that team represents the diversity of the audience you want to reach, then 9 times out of 10, you'll do a much better job of making that metaphor stretch across generations and cultures and geography.
Yeah, I think that's helpful. Let's talk about something that a lot of folk struggle with, and this is one of the other issues as it relates to particularly reaching more people. They're afraid that, you know, they're not going to get individuals who are going to help contribute financially to the mission of the church. What insights can you provide for how to help congregations understand that it's a process in terms of stewardship, and that, you know, that you can't just give up on reaching more people because you're trying to pay the bills of the church?
And so when most churches look at their financial records, most will discover that a fewer percentage of people actually help support the overall ministry than they would normally think. And so most churches have individuals who come who are not financially supporting the ministry. At Impact, that is the case for us. We don't see it as a lack of opportunity, but rather an opportunity. And it's an opportunity because, as you said, we have an opportunity to help teach discipleship and to teach stewardship. And say, for instance, somebody is 30 years old and they're not giving anything financially, but yet they're a strong volunteer and they're there every week and they're gainfully employed. Well, if they are 30 years old and they work full time until they're 60 or mid 60s, if we would be patient and intentional with them and teaching them stewardship, and if they're connected to your local church for a good part of their working career, then the resources that they would give financially to that church are staggering, as opposed to you looking at them and discounting them and not going through the hard work of discipleship to help them understand what Christianity says about generosity. So we see it as an opportunity, and you can do that through discipleship, metaphors, stewardship teaching. All of those, of course, are under discipleship, but any number of things that you can do to help people fully understand who they are in God and to be more generous, in particular financially.
As we come close to the end, a couple more questions. The first is, what is it that you think has fundamentally made a difference in your ministry in terms of being able to reach more people? There are a lot of individuals who, like you, have started congregations but have not really been able to connect with and reach people. So if you were to think about and reflect upon what really made a difference for you, what do you think has made a difference in your ability to reach more people?
You know, I think all congregations, whether they are small or large churches, are a sign of God's grace. And so, first and foremost, I give glory for God's grace and how God is using our team. And I'm consistent with saying our team because it is so much bigger than me at this phase in the mission field. I realize 20, 30, 40 years from now, when all of our faces are different, you know, my hope and prayer is that we're reaching even more people and that this original group is laying the foundation. But I do believe there are some very strategic things congregations can do that can help or hurt them. Starting a congregation or taking the existing congregation to the next level of health or growth is similar to a business model, meaning that you have to know who your customers are and who they will be. And in our world, we would say our congregation and who our congregation will be, and really doing the diagnostics of your community. So if you're in a community and the forecast is over the next 10 years, there will be a major ethnicity or cultural shift in population, and you're ignoring that, chances are you're going to cease to grow or not grow as a local church. So you have to know your community and who you're reaching and who you would like to reach. Then secondly, I believe it's important that as much as I love big box stores like Target and Walmart, I think the 21st century church growth and healthiest churches won't be big box models. They're going to be smaller boutique models, meaning that you can't come in and buy oil and milk, you know, in the same store. But we're going to give you the best car oil you've ever bought in your life. And there are five other churches down the road who do milk very well and other churches that do bread very well. And we're not in competition with them. We support each other. And I just think where the economy is, how transient people are, and just this, we're seeing it in technology. People are able to design their own systems. I think 21st century church is going to be boutique and self-designed systems where people have a lot more choice in the offerings. And these big, huge box store churches are just not going to be financially feasible, nor are they going to be fluid enough to be able to a change to or adjust to a quickly adjusting society. And so, you know, those are two of the things that I think are key, knowing the customer and also being smaller but and more flexible. And then finally, leadership is everything. I am not the best leader in the world, and I never will be. But part of my leadership ability is recognizing that. I've met a lot of church planters who don't recognize that. And so, you know, there's a popular hip-hop artist who has a song that says, "Be humble." And, you know, church planning, church leadership will cause you to be humble in so many different ways. And I think great leaders are those who know they're not the smartest people in the room. And the job that you have to do every single day is to pray that God will cover you and continue to give you grace, and that God will send you the right leaders to help lift the vision.
Thank you, and I appreciate that. As we get ready to close, the question that we end with is, who has been a mentor for you as you've developed your leadership style?
Oh, so many people. Walter Kimbrough, one, who gave me my first job as a youth pastor in Atlanta, Georgia at Cascade United Methodist Church. Our church would not be what it is today if it wasn't for him and the wonderful lay people at Cascade. Lawrence Young, a church planner who I met when I was 13 or 14 years old, who is a father to me and taught me so much as a teenager and to this very day, still speaks into my life. I look at folks in the business community, Roz Brewer, who is a part of our congregation. She most recently was president and CEO of Sam's Club, and now she is the chief operating officer of Starbucks. And so, you know, African-American woman who is a global leader, you know, I see her as a mentor. Ingrid Saunders-Jones, who was at Coca-Cola and led one of their global markets and brand initiatives, and just a very passionate person about leadership and people and very giving. So a large list of people, for-profit world, nonprofit world, church world. And so, and of course, a ton of other mentors and coaches who don't know they are mine, but I look at them from a distance and learn from them every single day.
Man, I appreciate it. Appreciate you taking the time. It's been a great conversation.
Well, thank you, friend. I appreciate you.
Leading Ideas Talks has been brought to you by the Taking Church to the Community Video Toolkit. Explore strategies your congregation can use to reach beyond its walls with worship, community events, ministries, and service to reach community members where they are. Taking Church to the Community is available on download and DVD at churchleadership.com/community. On our next episode of Leading Ideas Talks, Doug Poe speaks with Tim Shapiro and Kara Ferris about their book, Divergent Church. They examine innovative, alternative faith communities that combine religious practice with a church plus factor, that is, a dedicated focus on some unique aspect of their church's cultural DNA, like gardening, table fellowship, artistic expression, and more.
One of the marks, and surely one of the primary marks of the gatherings, communities that we learned from, was their attention to some aspect of life that the congregation attends to in addition to worship, or in addition to some of the other hallmarks that one might expect to find in a congregation. So there's the garden church that attends to growing, having a garden, really in the same, at least when we were studying them, in the same space in which they gathered for worship. There's the Galileo church that was focused on being attending to what it means to be a spiritual refugee. So almost all of these congregations attended to some aspect of life that became synonymous with their purpose, their intention, what they wanted to be about.
Leading Ideas Talks is available on iTunes, the Google Play Store, and Stitcher. Subscribe today. Thank you for joining us. And don't forget to subscribe free to Leading Ideas at churchleadership.com/leadingideas.